Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we have our guest from Australia, the CEO of Tectonic Gold, Brett Boynton. Hi, Brett. You're very welcome. How are you?
Morning, Mark. Good. Thank you very much for having me on.
I know it's really good to be talking to you. And Kenny, of course, from Scotland is with us as well.
Yeah. How are we doing, Brett? It's good to have you on.
Yeah, good. We've sort of had a bit of Scottish weather here today, actually. It's been grey and windy and lots of rain. So you'd feel right at home here today, Kenny.
Yeah, that's still shorts weather, shorts and T-shirt weather in Scotland. So it is. Yeah. And it's Queensland you're calling from?
No, I'm based in Sydney. Obviously, our projects are up in Queensland, yeah. But the corporate team is based in Sydney. Yep. And now that we're allowed to travel interstate with the COVID restrictions lifted, we are back and forth to Queensland. Yeah. But kind of Grand Central for us is Sydney.
Sydney, yeah. You just took the words straight out of my mouth. I was just going to ask, you know, how the COVID situation is in Australia, because we're obviously still in a lockdown, especially in Scotland. It's a bit tighter than what it is in England. Are you guys got light at the end of the tunnel? I think you're maybe 6, 7, 8 weeks ahead of us in the process.
Yeah, we've had a kind of infection spikes here and there, but you've got to recall that we pretty much shut the border. So, you know, although it's a big island, Australia is still an island, and like New Zealand, we shut the border. We had very, very strict controls for returning residents coming back and going through quarantine, et cetera. So we'd cut infection rates down to zero, community infection to zero, and a couple of returning residents sort of presenting. But in Australia, we've really had a really sort of lucky run. We started with people getting the jabs this week, I think. So healthcare workers have started on that. But really, the country domestically is open for business. You can travel around, and kind of domestic tourism is certainly on the go. And we're able to travel interstate to projects and things. It's just international. And I'm sitting with Sydney Harbour behind me, which at this time of year would normally be seeing plenty of cruise ships coming and going, but the cruise industry's shut down. Mm. It's a little odd in terms of isolation from an international point of view, but domestically it's business as usual now.
Good.
Excellent. Yeah, it seems like the world is finally coming back to some sort of normality, and there's at least a roadmap out of it from our perspective as well. But it's great to have you on. And the idea of these podcasts, Brett, is for we believe that people invest in people, and it's good to know about the people behind the businesses. So it's an opportunity for you to come on, tell us a bit about yourself, and we sometimes encourage our guests to go back as far as they want. You know, you can tell us where you were born, you know, what it was like growing up, you know, if you're a country boy, if you're a city boy, you know, maybe tell us a bit about your education, and then move on to your working career and, some of the companies you've worked for. So really it's an open platform just for you to give us a life bio almost.
Okay, Kenny, thanks. We're talking a bit about Scotland and the Scottish weather. Half of my heritage is from Scotland. My grandfather on my mum's side came out from Scotland to Africa, and he started prospecting, looking for gold. He was kind of the first in the line to do it. My father's side of the family's from further south, from Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. So although I'm Australia based now and grew up in Africa, my heritage is very much the UK. So there's a bit of adventure in the family. My grandfather came out and started prospecting. He needed to make some money to support his prospecting, so he started up a quarrying business and built a successful quarrying business, and then actually listed a gold company on the stock exchange in back in Rhodesia, as it was called then, Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. And so that side of the family built and ran very successful gold mining operations, 50 years ago. As things destabilized in Zimbabwe, my family moved down to South Africa. So we kind of moved out of the gold business, and I grew up in Cape Town, and the connection to the gold sort of heritage was still there, because every evening when the news came on and the gold price was announced, there was a kind of a hush as we all waited to hear what the gold price was today, because we still obviously had a lot of family exposure to gold. So it's very much in my blood. Mm. My training was in finance. I sort of went off and became a banker, not because I really knew what I was doing, but it seemed like an interesting thing to do at the time. I didn't really have a vocation for things like medicine or law or anything like that. So I ended up studying finance, and it was a good passport. I went and worked in London after university. Went and worked in London for Big Swiss Bank, and that was a great training. I got hired by the head of the banking operation for Europe, and really had a kind of apprenticeship in banking. I sat next to him for a few years and just watched how he did deals, how he engaged with clients, and how he kind of made things happen. Yep. And so it was quite a non-traditional sort of education in banking. It was, I guess, how merchant banking was 100 years ago. And that really set me on a path to, how I wanted to conduct business, how I wanted to build businesses. I recognized that I had some gaps to fill from a technical perspective. So got myself off to business school in the US. I got the bank to sponsor me, which I think was more a reflection of having the audacity to ask rather than any policy they had on helping kind of young cadets get going. But I had a great run. They moved me across to New York, and I studied in the US and learned a bit about how Americans do business, which is a little different. And then I kind of got the entrepreneurial bug at business school, and with one of my classmates, we tried to start up a tech company. It was just as the dot-com bust was happening, so nobody wanted to hear our tech ideas. But I was with an Aussie girl at the time, and she had an opportunity to move back, so I followed her to Sydney, and I landed in Sydney, and I thought, wow, this is just like Cape Town. And then discovered that half of Cape Town had already moved here. So it was a very easy move for me to come to Sydney. And I went back into banking, broking, helping raise capital for companies. Obviously, in Australia, the market is heavily skewed towards resources. So my client base very quickly became oil and gas, mining and exploration companies.
Yeah.
And that was my career for a few years, and then met the co-founder of our gold company, helping him on a project. And he said to me, "I've got these gold assets. Why don't you leave the bank and come and work with me, and we'll build a gold exploration company together." And he'd had a very, very successful listed gold company, bought a small property off BHP, taken it underground, built a very high return business there, and so was well respected in the industry. And I thought, well, this is a good partner to have to cut my teeth in moving from sort of banking into project development and corporate development. Around the same time, another one of my clients said, "I'm starting up another operation. Why don't you leave the bank and come and join me?" And so I got the two of them together, and I said, "Look, it would make sense that we all share office space, and why don't we do that? And we'll incubate all of these things together." And so I started working on projects with people I liked working with, and I was really very fortunate. We had a couple of early successes. I'm still involved in all of those projects as a shareholder. Yep. And from there, developed a career really in finding interesting projects, building teams around those projects, raising the capital to develop the projects and build the business, and then either taking them through to a listing or finding an exit with a buyout of those projects. And so I've been very successful. You know, one or two that didn't work so well, probably learned more from those. Certainly found out that when the chips are down, you've got to make sure you've got real friends around you, because you know, when you're losing money and you've lost shareholders' money and they're phoning you up and they're kind of angry, justifiably, you've taken their money and not delivered a result. You need to have a plan. You need to be able to recover from that. You need to be able to important that you're able to look your shareholders in the eye and say, you know, we gave this a proper effort. We didn't waste the money. I've never taken money as in a salary out of, you know, I've never taken cash out of Tectonic. I've always said I'm 100% aligned with shareholders. I only ever take equity, and I've never sold any equity. So certainly encouraged the rest of the team to participate heavily in the equity side, not take cash out. And all of our directors are on kind of non-cash remuneration. So those kind of things, I'm sort of proud of that way of doing business. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we've been able to, you know, with our success, attract good projects to us. In Tectonic, we've been able to find a really excellent portfolio of ground that technical people have brought us. We didn't go and do corporate deals to build the portfolio. We built a reputation in the market that we look at interesting things. We apply a real research and scientific lens to it, and that's attracted geologists with interesting pieces of ground and interesting projects to come and look to partner up with us. And so over the years, we've looked at a lot of different projects. Not all of them fit the bill for Tectonic, certainly. What we've filtered out from over 100 projects that we've looked at has left us with a great core portfolio that we're developing at Tectonic now. Yep. So, I guess from a dusty little town in Africa where I was born to kind of growing up in Cape Town, and then sort of moving into sort of mainstream banking in the city, and then a bit of a stint on Wall Street, in a roundabout way, gave me a really good background for becoming a kind of executive in a gold exploration business.
That's good.
Yeah, it sounds as if you've had a decent apprenticeship, if you want to call it that. You've been about. You're a man of the world, so it always helps in these situations. So at the time you joined Tectonic, Brett, that was still a private company, a PTY company in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. So when I left the bank, my co-founder Peter had a project that he'd picked up when he sold his previous business, which was the Browns Creek mine, Hargraves Resources, and he sold that to a large gold production company. And then he picked up a few other assets, one of which was the Mount Cassidy asset, which we've been doing some work on just in January. And he'd had an inkling from the work that he'd done at Browns Creek, which he developed as an underground mine at the same time as the Cadia discovery was made very close by. So on the east coast of Australia, Cadia is Newcrest's flagship mine in New South Wales. And Browns Creek was just down the road from that. So Peter had taken this open pit, not very large scale mine, too small for BHP. So he bought it off BHP. And then he's a mining engineer. So he had a view on how to turn it into a successful underground operation. And listed that on the Australian Stock Exchange to raise the funds to take that underground. It was a very, very profitable mine. I think at the time it was one of the sort of two or three lowest cost per ounce producers in Australia. So very successful operation. Yep. Then when he sold that, he picked up Mount Cassidy and some other assets. But the experience of taking Browns Creek underground had led him and his geologists in that project to have a rethink about what was the generally accepted geology of the east coast of Australia. And that, in a sense, was a precursor to our thinking now around intrusive related gold systems. And so these kind of maps, geological maps that have been developed over decades of areas around the world, and certainly in Australia, but it's applicable in other areas as well. They're kind of a mosaic of, you know, information that's sort of cobbled together. Governments do a bit of work. They take some private enterprise kind of findings and they stitch together what they think is what's happening with the geology in an area. But until you get teams come in and really do primary research on that ground and serious exploration, they're often just a best guess. And it turned out that the best guess in Australia, we thought, was quite far off the mark in terms of the kind of plate tectonic history of the east coast of Australia. So if you recall from, I don't know if you did sort of high school geography, you would have come across plate tectonics, the plates moving around on the Earth's surface. And in the east coast of Australia, what you've got is a kind of microcontinent sort of smashing into the Queensland coast, and you get a what's called isostatic rebound. So you kind of like a rubber ball, you bounce it and it bounces back up, you bounce it down again. You've got this microcontinent smashing into the coast of Australia, rebounds, smashes in again, rebounds. And that geological activity created significant fracturing in the Earth's crust. And fault lines in the Earth's crust. And that's the ground preparation for intrusives to come up. So if you have a volcano come up and it kind of comes all the way up to the surface, you imagine that same activity, but the volcano doesn't penetrate the Earth's crust all the way through to the surface. It's contained, you know, 1 or 2 kilometers below the surface. And so you've got this massive pressure event, high temperature, molten rock from deep in the Earth's liquid sort of center, punching up and bringing with it the minerals that we're after. Right, we're looking for the gold and the copper and the other economic minerals. Yep. And this cools and settles, and over tens of millions of years, then erosion brings that to the surface and uncovers those mineral deposits. Now, as this is happening, you know, the tectonic plates are still moving around. So you've got this kind of mobile jigsaw puzzle, if you will. And we're talking about periods of tens of millions of years. So it's actually quite difficult to come along in, 2020 and have a look at a piece of ground and go, well, this is what the geology is, because you've got incredible complexity. And in the case of Australia, it's a very ancient continent. You've got significant periods of erosion. It's very hard to sort of re-engineer what happened over those tens of millions of years. But that's really the job of the exploration geologist at a high level, to find out where the areas are that are prospective for large-scale mineralization. And that was our first piece of work. So that inkling that Peter had going underground at Browns Creek, that things weren't as they seemed. And then, you know, we kind of scratched at that for a while, got into the ground, did some real work, looked at the actual rocks and said, this doesn't match what the maps say is actually here. And so we recast the maps, and that led to our success in sort of rejecting the kind of the known history and going and rethinking it ourselves. We identified that although a lot of gold has been found in Queensland, there are areas which are highly prospective for additional discoveries, but because of geological activity, they might still be a little bit undercover. The surface expression isn't as obvious, and so they're harder to find. And indeed, what we've seen on most of our ground is historic explorers have come and they've kind of poked around a bit. They've dug some test holes. They've done some chemical testing, but they've never really stitched the whole thing together. And so our breakthrough was to say, well, if we're right, if we're going to find these large deposits, how are we going to go about finding them? Because it's too expensive to start drilling deep holes, you know, all over Queensland. It's a big piece of ground. You can't just drill and hope. And so we had to adopt some new technologies. We brought in some ideas from the oil and gas industry, deep penetrating geophysics, and that gave us additional information. We used very advanced geochemical testing procedures, the kind of things you'd only see in BHP, Newcrest. You certainly wouldn't see a lot of what we do in other junior exploration companies. And then we went to the Australian federal government and we said, look, we think we're onto something here, but some research needs to be done. And if we get this right, it's going to open up a lot of opportunity for the gold industry. And so we applied for participation in the Australian federal government's research and development rebate program, which effectively gives you almost 50 cents on the dollar back on all of your expenditure. And that turned our fortunes around, because suddenly we went from, you know, operating on the sniff of an oily rag to having federal government funding. We needed to go and raise some capital, but we could tell investors, look, we're going to get half of this back and be able to spend it again. So we're really going to be able to leverage up our efforts. And so so that gave us a sort of change in fortune. And that's at the end of that process is, right, well, now we need to get into some drilling, and we really need to make good to our shareholders to get their equity into a listed environment so they could trade if they wanted to, and also to give us access to capital markets so we could raise more capital if we needed to. And that's when we reversed into a shell and then onto the Aquis Exchange in London.
Yeah, I was just about to say it's quite a journey from Rhodesia to South Africa to Sydney to Queensland and back to London and the Aquis Exchange. I mean, how do you find Aquis Exchange? Obviously, it's changed from the next exchange to Aquis, but it seems to be coming more mainstream now. And I've got a few positions open in companies on the Aquis Exchange, so it's you don't need a phone. It used to be a phone only exchange, but now quite a few of the platforms are offering online dealing as well.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, more and more brokers coming onto or putting Aquis onto their platforms every week. You know, when we reversed into the UK shell, it was really to get access to the cash in the shell. Part of the requirement there was to be on a listed, to have a listing on an exchange. So at the time, it was NEX, and it was a cost-effective way to kind of meet that commitment in order to close the transaction and get access to that capital so we could go and do some drilling. So at the time, it wasn't we weren't sort of looking at, you know, what's the liquidity in the exchange, who's participating here, are institutions participating here. We simply wanted a low-cost way to get to close a transaction which required us to have a listing. That was probably a bit naive at the time, because we then did have some success and wanted to come back for more capital. And it was very difficult because there was very limited liquidity on the NEX. But the Aquis team have really turned this around now. There's been a big media drive. They've done a lot of kind of corporate development work. And the brokers are really coming on board with this. So it's a virtuous circle, as you mentioned. You know, a couple of successes, especially in the crypto space, and that's created a lot of interest in the exchange itself. And then as we've increased our own, I guess, investor relations effort, as a result, our liquidity has improved as well. So I think what we found with Aquis is, you know, a lot of people have said, when are you going to move to the AIM? When are you going to move to the LSE? Will you do an ASX listing? And we're certainly open to all of those ideas. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of M&A activity in the gold space, especially the junior mining space at the moment. So we'd always thought, well, if we merge with an ASX, TSX, LSE listed company, that, you know, maybe that's our path to a bigger, more liquid exchange. But right now, the strides being made by the team at Aquis are very encouraging, and you know, we were able to raise capital last year and really shift things forward. Our shareholders have been pretty supportive, so we're very pleased with the Aquis. We think it's a very, very cost effective solution for us. If we needed to access much larger amounts of capital for project development down the line, and that necessitated going to a more liquid exchange to get access to institutional investors, then that's certainly on the cards. But, you know, already we see some institutions committing to come into Aquis. So, you know, perhaps by June that won't even be necessary.
Excellent. And just to confirm, you guys own 100% of your projects in Queensland.
That's right. Yes, all of our portfolio. The only thing we don't own 100% of is we had a couple of projects we were working up in South Africa, which we sold down to AIM-listed Kazira. We just have a non-diluting 10% interest in those, and Kazira's just put out some announcements earlier this week. Their production is sort of ramping up. They just started producing on a small diamond concession in December, and they're working through the ramp up phase, and that seems to be going well. So we've got a good economic interest in that, and we're happy to hang on to that. We also hold a reasonable piece of Kazira directly in equity, 20 million shares, and another 20 million options. But that's a bit of a sidecar, and was a sort of an investment, if you will, to generate some cash flow, which we could recycle back into Tectonic. In terms of Tectonic, the subsidiary company in Australia has 100% ownership of all of our licenses.
Yep. And it's three main projects you have in that portfolio.
Yeah, that's right. Well, three main project areas, because within each project area, they're kind of multiple targets.
Yeah.
And so the lead project area, if you will, at Specimen Hill, there's a sort of 5 kilometer long strike we've mapped at surface. So we've got mineralization at surface through this 5 kilometer long corridor. We've drilled about 800 meters of that down to 150 meters, and we've had 100% success in that. We're intersecting the mineralization in all of those holes. So what we'll ultimately end up with there is kind of a string of pearls, really, where we'll have pods of mineralization that are economically mineable, and you'll have, yeah, near surface, you'll have open pits going off to the sort of top 100 meters of the kind of sheet of mineralized ore, and below that you'd go into underground operations. But we see that as kind of, I guess, if you look at something like the Cadia operation, where they've got multiple open pits and underground all feeding a central plant, that's the kind of development you could expect at Specimen Hill. Multiple pits along the strike, and then going underground into that high-grade underground mining, feeding a central processing plant. That's how we envisage it.
Yeah, and the Mount Cassidy prospect, I see that you guys, well, the founders have been involved for 20 years with this particular project.
Yeah, so now that's an interesting piece of ground. So Cassidy was the piece of ground that Peter picked up when he sold Hargraves in 1998. So it's over 20 years now. And really, I guess, for no other reason than he had other projects that were sort of taking his time and focus, Cassidy was on hold. A little bit of work done here and there. You need to. There's a kind of a use it or lose it rule on your tenements in Queensland. So you have to do some complying work every year to progress the asset. Otherwise, you lose the license. So he did. sporadic work on it here and there to maintain the license, but really didn't have the bandwidth to, you know, properly prosecute it until I hopped out of banking and came in full time to work these assets and build a portfolio. So it was really somewhat dormant for the better part of a decade, and then we started to work things up privately, and then we realized we needed to put a team in place, and that meant kind of incorporating and getting serious about it, raising some capital and putting some proper research into it.
Yep. Mark, sorry, I've been doing quite a lot of talking here. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, well, you know all about everything going on down in Australia, don't you? You're a bit of a...
Yeah, I love Australia, so I do. Yeah. I'm into all the, you know, the mineral databases, yeah. TenGraph, GeoView, Strike, GeoVic. I'm well into them. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting for me because, I mean, we talked to a few companies in Australia. And it's obviously that you're based, all the projects are based in Queensland. I think there's a company, the Rockfire Resources, are also based there. We know David Price fairly well. He was actually one of our first guests on the podcast. But there's also Panther Metals, who operate in the Northern Territories, and then, of course, Victoria. So, I mean, is Australia underexplored for gold? Or, you know, there seems to be almost gold projects all over the place.
Sure. I'll just jump back onto David Price at Rockfire, because he is our neighbor geologically up in Queensland. But there's an interesting piece of history there, because David was the geologist with Peter when they went underground at Browns Creek. So he's part of this thinking about, you know, what is the real geology up in Queensland and the east coast of Australia. So Rockfire and Tectonic are very much aligned in our thinking that they're deposits slightly different to ours, a little further north, but no, we know David well. In terms of is Australia underexplored, yeah, there's a bit of history about this. So sort of after World War II, I guess, the gold exploration in Western Australia started to attract more and more of the capital and the expertise, because it is it's closer to surface, small open pittable operations that small syndicates could more cost effectively go after, and so that took a lot of the attention away from the East Coast, which to some extent became the sort of playground of the big players. You needed to have a big balance sheet like a Newcrest to go after something like Cadia. And the reason for that was because the technology we have today, which we take for granted, wasn't available to those earlier explorers. So the kind of deep penetrating geophysical reconnaissance that we do, that wasn't even in research back then, right? That kind of technology wasn't available, certainly not to the junior explorers. So it wasn't cost effective to go after these sort of vertically extensive gold deposits. So that's why I say the easy to find stuff, the gold deposits, copper deposits with a very big surface expression, or as the Queenslanders like to say, stuck out like the dog's bollocks. They were found and they were prosecuted and developed into you know, spectacular mining stories such as such as Cadia, you know, Ravenswood, Timbara, all through that belt, probably close to 50 million ounces of gold had been discovered and mined by the 1980s, 1990s. The problem then was, where was the rest of it? Where was the next generation of gold discoveries? And these were the ones that were less obvious. And so it was in the 80s that Cadia was discovered. And, you know, famously, the story goes that the geologist kind of walked off, had given up and hadn't told the drilling contractor to stop drilling. So they carried on drilling and, you know, hit the major intersection that... then led to the discovery and development of Cadia. So it was there's a bit of history kind of post-World War II where the capital required and the kind of expertise required to cover the exploration kind of methodically was all drawn away to Western Australia. And that was the start of the sort of the real boom in Western Australian gold story. And it's only more recently with technology driving down the cost of exploration and enabling the type of exploration that we do, certainly, that more players like ourselves and Rockfire have come back into the East Coast, northern New South Wales and into Queensland. So that's part of the story. More recently, we've seen the majors come in. So, last year, Rio, they're obviously after the copper more than the gold, South 32 as well, started to build a presence in, much more significant presence in Queensland. Mm-hmm. Rio has taken a big area of ground right on the northern fence line of our Specimen Hill project. And that's very encouraging for us because our business model as an explorer is much like a property developer. We take it through to development ready, but we're not the developers. We don't have the balance sheet to build and operate a mine. And although our team have all been through that process, so it's integral to our thinking, is this something that can be taken into a mine? We're not just exploring for the intellectual pursuit of making a discovery. There needs to be some real hard economics around. Are we going after something that is going to be of interest to one of the majors? We think about that in terms of what is going to get Newcrest to come and look at our data room, what's going to get Evolution to come and look at our data room. And it's very clear to us, we need to have 3 million ounces of gold or prospectivity for 3 million ounces of gold, because otherwise it doesn't shift the dial for them, right? They need to see 300,000 ounces of production and a 10-year mine life. And so when we're looking at projects and we say, well, there's some interesting grade there, we're seeing some quite high grade there even. If you're in WA, you can find 40,000 ounces and that's pretty profitable to go after. You can dig it up, send it down the road, have it toll treated, and you can make millions of dollars out of that, recycle that, go and do other small kind of sub 50,000 ounce projects. But that doesn't cut it in Queensland because the type of deposit there is quite different. So you need to have a much more meaningful deposit to go after because you need to sink hundreds of millions of dollars into development and operations and build large-scale mining operations there. So so to that extent, Queensland is very much underexplored and we see a lot of opportunity. If we had the balance sheet, there's a lot of ground we'd go and pick up where, we've had the success of looking at areas and saying, we think there's something there that others have overlooked. There's plenty of other areas that we feel the same about, but we've got a limited budget, so we can't go and grab them all. But certainly, as we trade out of our first and second asset, we'll be looking to buy in more projects. And so we think we've got a very sustainable business model from that perspective.
Okay. Yeah.
So what's the roadmap looking like for 2021 then for Tectonic, Brett? What's the key takeaways for 2021?
Yeah, so we've had a really positive start to our drilling campaign. We kicked off in December, had some great results out of that. Again, we've got this 5 kilometer long strike at Specimen Hill. We've drilled out about 800 meters of it with kind of sparsely spaced drilling. So we need to go back and increase the density of the drilling. The success of the drilling to date certainly warrants that. We'll go back in and increase the density of that drilling. That'll take us into kind of resource definition. And then we need to move further through that that mineralized corridor and test the rest of that that zone. So we've got some very juicy targets at Southern Copper was a discovery we made after the bushfires went through there, if you remember about 18 months ago now, it seemed like half of Australia was on fire, which is terrible and devastating in many areas. The thing we benefited from was that for the first time in a generation, the undergrowth was cleared out by the fire. So our geologists could get onto the ground, and instead of seeing, you know, thick grass, they were able to see the rocks directly. And that immediately led to the discovery at Southern Copper. We had that tested, very high copper grades, exceptionally high gold grades with that. So we'd like to get back in and drill that certainly in the next few weeks, if not months. We've got a large collection of samples ready to go through assay. So in December, when we drilled, we sent a batch of the samples for accelerated assay. And the reason for that was twofold. One, we wanted to just make sure we were our drill targeting was accurate and we were getting the results we expected. And two, to give us a baseline so that we could use that as a reference for the rest of the drilling and compare the results from our screening. We use some technology called XRF where we go and you can just scan the rock chips straight away and with a handheld scanner, and you get a reading, and if it matches the reading from known gold-bearing mineralization, you've got a very high degree of confidence that there's going to be copper and gold in those readings as well. So we've got about 1,500 samples from Specimen Hill, which we've pre-screened now. And out of that, very happy to report that we've got about 500 samples that we're going to send through for assay. So, at least a third of the sample will go through for assay. From that, we're getting some pretty thick intersections. So with RC drilling, you get 1 meter intersections and you get a bag of chips for that meter. And we've tested with the XRF scanning, 30 sequential bags. So we know that we've got 30 sequential meters showing copper and gold mineralization, reporting copper and gold mineralization from the XRF scanning. That looks very similar to the intersections we got in December. So that's stuff that's got to go through for formal assay, and then we can report those grades. But we're very encouraged by that. And then we, in January, after the Christmas break, came in and did our kind of reconnaissance drilling, our first drilling at Mount Cassidy. So that's the first asset we had, which Peter picked up way back in 1998. And we're very encouraged with that. The drilling looks good so far. The visual kind of analytics with the geologist, just with a hand lens looking at the rocks as they come out, confirmed we're getting good intersections of sulfides. That's the host that holds the gold and the copper. Yeah. So if there's gold and copper, it's in the sulfides, and we're getting sulfides. And we know from surface sampling that there's a pretty good grade there, up to over 30 grams per ton. So that's all in the relatively short term. And then back into drilling and more information coming out of that, news flow coming out of that. Now, you've got to remember that we're not drilling for market reporting here. Our program is really designed to build up a database to take to discussion with a Rio, with a Newcrest, with a South 32 Goldfield, somebody like that, to come in and partner with us to take this through completion of resource definition into production. So although we will be getting a lot of kind of retail news flow, really our focus is to build this up for a corporate opportunity, and ideally that's something we'll be able to execute over the months ahead as well. So we're well into building that program up for Specimen Hill. And again, as soon as we can show that there's prospectivity for 3 million ounces of gold, we think there'll be a lot of parties.
Yeah, there was one thing in your presentation, Brett, that caught my eye. It says tectonic, ready to repeat, greater than gold, 75 times in 3 years. That's quite a thing to pin your, hang your hat upon. So it is as a company, but it's impressive, when you see statements like that in a presentation, it jumps out. So it does.
Yeah, look, Greatland have done a fantastic job, and before them, ASX listed Gold Road, and it's a pretty kind of recognizable formula. We're the exploration guys. Get out there, make the discovery, start to delineate it, show the scale of it, and then show the market that it's serious by bringing a big partner in. So we're well into that journey. We've made the discovery. We've made multiple discoveries. Our drill targeting has been 100% accurate over two drilling campaigns now. We've hit gold on every single drill hole. We're not getting the kind of grades you get in WA. It's a different type of mineralization we're after. So we're going to get the kind of medium grade stuff, sort of 2 to 10 grams. We'll get intersections where there'll be small areas of higher grade, and we've had intersections up above 15 grams and certainly surface sampling up to over 30 grams. But we have the copper as well. And so that copper credit makes it eminently more attractive to the likes of a Rio or South 32. So we think we're well lined up to have those conversations with the bigger players and say, look, you know, the likes of Evolution earlier this week or last week just reported their highest ever cash half, cash earnings half. So, you know, Evolution as a business is extremely efficient at digging the gold out of the ground, processing it and selling it at a high margin. But they need somebody to replace the ounces they're pulling out. And they're happy to pay a premium to buy those, you know, high quality. And by high quality, I mean in a, you know, good, stable jurisdiction like Australia, easy to operate in environment and literally just up the road from where they are. So, you know, if our job is to delineate the gold and you know, find the opportunity that has the scale to attract an Evolution. Evolution sitting on the other side of the table with a big pile of cash looking for something to buy. So it should be a good opportunity for us to go and pitch what we've got and find good quality partners to exactly repeat what Gold Road, Greatland and others have done.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think that's probably about 40 minutes of been talking, Brett, which it just flies in when you start talking.
Yeah.
So it does. Mark, do you get in to finish off with, and we'll let Brett go on with his evening?
No, not particularly. Yeah, I know it's getting into a late evening for you there, Brett, so we can let you go. But I think, yeah, just touching on what you said about technology that wasn't available to past miners, that's what I'm sort of hearing quite a lot. And there's a lot of blind discoveries that are still yet to be discovered all over Australia. And it's fantastic. And I look forward to seeing how you progress with your projects as well. But thank you very much for coming on today and giving us all of that. It's great.
Well, thank you both, gents. I really appreciate the opportunity to share a bit about what we're doing. And often with the RNSs, the broker says, you know, just make 5 bullet points. So it's nice to have a chat and be able to share a bit more about who we are as a business, the kind of people we have involved, and, you know, what drives us to put on the boots and get out there and go and look at those rocks again and again.
Yeah.
All right. Good stuff, right? We'll let you go, Brett, and appreciate your time.
Thanks, gents. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.